Hello and welcome to Heavy Meta. I am your host, Bryce Kundick, flying solo today. Kelly is not with me, but thankfully I'm joined by the illustrious Michael Johnson.
Hello.
Do you want to introduce yourself?
So I am Michael Johnson. I am a professor of English in the Humanities Division at the University of Maine, Farmington.
Excellent. How long have you been at UMF?
I arrived in 2000.
2000, so 16 years.
Yeah.
That's a lot of years. Does it feel like a lot of years?
It feels like a lot of years.
I've been here for 9, so you got me beat perpetually by 7 years. There's nothing I can do about it. Go away for 7 years and then come back and then we can be tied.
So we have those, every 5 years we get these little things from UMF to commemorate our years of service at
right.
UMF. I'm going to be moving soon from the large group to the smaller group as we move upwards, as I move toward 20 years, right?
Yes, that's true.
Well, that's a depressing way to
do it. It is, but you know, sometimes the perks, you know, you get nicer stuff in those smaller groups. I'll
true.
Say that.
So
you know.
a better water bottle. Makes
better
sense.
Water bottle, only the finest metal. English. You're an English professor. What do you teach in English?
So my large area is American literature. Within American literature, I teach courses in African American literature and multicultural literature. Also, film and literature courses, something that I do quite often as well.
Very cool. Yeah.
And zombies. Zombies and superheroes, I should add.
It would be great if every professor I interviewed added "and zombies" at the end of, you know, like we were interviewing Peter Hardy, who was like, yeah, I teach mathematics and zombies, you know.
Well, I do include in my bio on the UMF website that I'm the departmental expert on surviving the zombie apocalypse.
Excellent. Now I know who to go to in the English department. We got humans versus zombies every year. I can just
exactly
run.
I get all my advice from the students who are playing.
Nice. And today specifically, we're going to talk about a book that you wrote. Tell us a little bit about it.
So my book is Hoodoo Cowboys and Bronze Buckaroos: Conceptions of the African American West. It was published in 2014 by University Press of Mississippi. It is a look at the African-American West. It is a look at the experience of African-American people as they moved westward. It also is a book that looks at the way that we, not only the reality of the African-American West, but it also looks at the way that the African-American West has been imagined. So I look at, for example, writers who write about living in Montana or South Dakota, or California, or Montana, or I said Montana, or wherever else in the West. But I also look at genres like the Western that have had African-American characters in them, which often aren't necessarily related to actual Western,
right.
Actually living in the West, but are more generic and imaginative in the way that they think about the West and representing the West.
Yeah, I mean, I've read articles, or, you know, online, I mean, this is, we're talking about like BuzzFeed or something, so it's, when you can say, I've read articles, and you sound smart. As soon as you're like, I read a BuzzFeed article, and then you plummet. But basically outlining how different the reality of the West was from the way it was depicted, about how, you know, the cowboy in film is typically white guy, you know, riding into the rescue, whereas in actuality, now this is just from what I've read, in actuality it was very multicultural. A lot of minorities were cowboys, not white guys.
Well,
is it accurate?
Working, well, I mean, to a certain extent, yeah, it is. Because working with cattle is actually it's not a very good job. It's a working class job, and at least, you know, in the areas of the West that had slavery, this would have been a job that the slaves would have been doing.
Mm.
The cowboy of the Western film is sort of the hero, is nothing to do with actual cowboy,
right?
And, you know, the actual ranch work that you'd be doing if you were a cowboy.
So, what made you want to write about this?
You know, this has been an interest of mine for a while. It actually got started with my dissertation way back in whenever, and I was interested in the way that the frontier had been reimagined in the 20th century, like sort of after the so-called closing of the West, but the way that the frontier continued to be an important metaphor. And I was looking at writers in the 1960s who were sort of trying to do a kind of Kennedy-esque new frontier, or mm-hmm. reimagine the frontier. And very often what has shifted was that they had begun to like look at urban life as the new frontier for particularly for whites, white adventurers, right? So for Norman Mailer, he created this character type that he called the white hipster, called the white Negro, right?
Okay.
Who was a hipster whose frontier was the nightlife of the American city. And what happened is that he essentially replayed the story of the Western, that set it in an urban environment, and rather than encountering Indians, what his hipsters were doing were encountering African Americans and jazz performers and jazz. And you got this weird sort of like restatement of Western mythology through
really?
The lens of the jazz scene.
And did the jazz musicians spontaneously attack him or something? I mean, like, I'm trying to take the Western tropes I know and like, how did it work? Like,
well, that actually was my question.
Okay.
as I was looking at these writers like Mailer, it was my question. It's like, okay, so how did the how did African Americans in this period feel about being
right.
positioned in this way, and how did they imagine the frontier? And so that was what got me looking at some writers in the 1960s. William Gardner Smith was one writer that I looked at. Another was the name I'm going to forget because it was a while back.
Right.
But they both of those writers were really sort of working with frontier tropes, I discovered, but they were resetting the frontier overseas. And so their encounters were not with Indians or with African-Americans or with Norman Mailer, but they were often going into these stories, they're going into these third world countries, right? And their encounters with an other on the frontier was usually with someone who was opposed to white colonialism.
Okay.
So for William Gardner Smith, it was the Algerians in Paris that he meets. And the story sort of plays out very much like a Western, complete with a showdown at the end. But it's this sort of battle of colonial powers and colonized people fighting back.
Okay.
So that's what got me into thinking about African Americans in the West. And I guess the next step was to say, okay, well, if this is going on, if this reimagined frontier, what if I go back and look at more traditional Western writing? What are African Americans doing there? And what I found was there was a lot of material that just wasn't really being talked about.
So tell us a bit about it. Like, what was the African American experience in the West?
Well, I guess I should say that it varied, right?
Okay.
One way that it was different is that it often was an urban experience, which is an experience of the West we often don't associate with the mythology of the West.
Right.
So living in the city, we think of living in the West as living out on the ranch somewhere. But for most people, the experience in the West is living in Denver or living in Los Angeles.
Right? Really?
Yeah, because they're the bigger cities. They're the
right,
bigger
that's
places.
Where the,
that's where people are.
Figure.
But that's not the West. That's not the West of the Western or sort of the mythology of the West. But there are also there's an autobiography by Nat Love, The Life and Adventures of Nat Love. And he was a black cowboy, and this is his autobiography, is his life as a black cowboy. I think it's like The Life and Adventures of Nat Love, better known as Deadwood Dick, or something along those lines.
Okay.
Is the title. But it's sort of, I guess I should describe it as a fusion of dime novel and autobiography. So he appears to have been a black cowboy. If you go and search black cowboy on the internet, you will come to Nat Love's photograph. There's a famous photograph that he included in the autobiography of him in his cowboy outfit. So he's there, he's got his saddle beside him, he's got his chaps on, he's got his gun by his side.
Did he face any persecution and racism, I'm sure?
Yes, he claims he didn't, right? He says that his life as a black cowboy was a life where he was regarded and accepted as an equal. At the same time, there are moments in the book that suggest that other things might have been happening,
okay.
Right? And the experience of other black cowboys that historians have looked at suggests that it's unlikely that he lived the kind of life of equality that he claims for himself,
right,
in the autobiography.
So I'll admit, when I looked at the book, I could only, off the top of my head, think of two, I guess, black cowboy movies that sprung to mind, and they're probably the ones that you normally get. I had Blazing Saddles and Django Unchained, which are quite different films. Do you cover either of those in the book, and how do you cover them if you do?
They both get a piece in the book. Blazing Saddles, by the time we get to Blazing Saddles in 1970-something,
mm-hmm.
there actually have been quite a surprising number of black cowboy films in the 60s and 70s. So there were spaghetti westerns that were made in Europe.
Right.
Right. There were a bunch of those that were made featuring famous football player.
O.J. Simpson?
No. O.J. Simpson. Fred Williamson was one of those,
okay,
football player, but an even more famous football player whose name I am blanking on.
Okay.
I'll come back to that.
It'll come to you, don't worry, yeah.
Yeah, the spaghetti westerns were more inclusive racially than a lot of American westerns were.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was like a tradition of those that were taking place with black characters in them. They're also, you know, starting in the 60s, there's a series of revisionist westerns came out, they sometimes feature black characters. So one actor was Woody Strode, who was in a bunch of John Ford films.
Mm.
So he played the feature role in Sergeant Rutledge, in which he played a Buffalo Soldier.
So these weren't cases of like, and starring the white guy, and oh, there's some black supporting actors in the background, doing the...
Yeah, they were sort of...
Yes and no? Okay.
Yeah, okay. Even though he was the title character, the film focused more on his white lawyer representing him, because he
Great.
Was falsely accused of a crime.
Okay.
But he had a pretty substantial part in...
Like To Kill a Mockingbird,
yeah,
Western
exactly,
style.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Huh.
So they, not perfect.
Right.
Right. But there already had been some efforts at including... trying to find ways to include black actors into these films from the 60s.
So was Blazing Saddles seen as like a step forward, sort of the weird Mel Brooksian whatever? I mean, like,
in some ways, it's like, I almost feel now that Blazing Saddles was kind of a parody of these films from the 60s.
Okay.
Right, that it was already parodying the black cowboy figure, right? But that there had been enough films with black cowboys that
it fits into that. And
yeah. With Blazing Saddles, Richard Pryor was one of the screenwriters.
Really?
Yeah. And he won was one of the three screenwriters who won an Academy Award, I think, for Best Screenplay.
Did he win Best Screenplay?
Yeah,
I
think
remember,
so.
Yeah.
I think that's right.
Okay.
So Blazing Saddles already, with Richard Pryor there, he was participating in any, it was kind of a mainstreaming of black humor that was taking place in the late 60s and
mm-hmm.
late 70s. And Richard Pryor was certainly at the forefront
right.
of that. It actually is doing some things that we see in black humor of the period, particularly in its satire of white racism, right? Which is much more pronounced in that movie than it is in other movies that might have characters in them.
And, I watch it today with people who haven't seen it, and it's interesting to me how they react to Blazing Saddles,
mm-hmm.
because it's like, I'm laughing, but I'm not sure. They almost don't know if they were making fun of it or if that, does that make sense? I mean, like, to me, it's clearly satire. It's clearly, I mean, like, I know 100% Mel Brooks was not, at least I can't imagine a world where Mel Brooks really was being wildly racist. He was purposely poking fun at how racist it was. But when people look at it retroactively, I think they have in their head, well, yeah, people were all racist back then, and so maybe that movie's...
Right, or that they're, they're broad comic types in the film,
right.
which I think also can often be read as being racist stereotypes.
Right.
I think it works pretty well.
Yeah, I mean, I still think, I love the movie.
Well, I mean, the only problem really that I have with Blazing Saddles is that it's become sort of like the only.
Right. But then you had
sort of, you sort of lose all the other sort of context that emerges from.
But Quentin Tarantino, you know, showed up, you know, just a few years ago to do Django Unchained. What are your thoughts on that one?
I do have the final chapter here discusses Django Unchained, and it kind of looks at it in terms, at least in terms of the way that the film was marketed, which
okay.
I'm highly critical of, because Tarantino says something to the effect that he invented the genre of the black western, right? That he got this idea and thought, wow, this is like virgin snow, right? No one has done this before.
Which is surprising for Tarantino, because he tries to pass himself off as this like encyclopedia of film knowledge, and he knows everything there is to know about it. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
He really, like, that's the persona he likes to exude. He's also definitely, I don't know the man personally, but he comes across as very full of himself.
Mm-hmm.
And so if anyone were to be like, yes, I invented this, it would be him.
Yes, it works well for the marketing, and it got picked up by sort of the press and the media, and that became sort of the trope of this, that it was something new. I guess, as a film, I liked Django Unchained. I thought it did a lot of the things that I enjoyed. But I thought there was an opportunity there for it to be also a kind of history lesson, that they could have made audiences more aware of the history that the film was participating in, instead of pretending that it was something that was new.
Right.
And that didn't really happen with the film.
Interesting.
You may remember this, this is like in the 90s, a film called Posse.
No.
Okay, it was directed by Mario Van Peebles.
Okay.
Right, and actually his, it was kind of a homage to the spaghetti westerns, but it was an all-black cast film, and it was set in a black town, a ship that was threatened.
Mm.
And he did a number of things in that film to indicate his awareness that he was part of a longer history, even of films about the African-American West, particularly in his casting. One of his casting choices was to bring Woody Strode essentially out of retirement. And Woody Strode was this time maybe in his 90s, at least
wow.
in his late 80s. And he became part of the frame of the story.
Mm-hmm.
He's the storyteller who actually tells the story that unfolds on screen. And that kind of choice of casting is an homage to his role for 30 years of Westerns, right, that he participated in.
Interesting.
And at the end of the film, there was this wonderful montage of over the final credits in which he put together clips from older Westerns with black characters, including the films that Herb Jeffries was in, and put them together actually with clips from his film. And you got this wonderful sort of like 4 or 5 minutes of this like second film after the first film almost.
Really?
Because the way he cut things together, it was as if the story was continuing from one film to the next. So you go from a fight in 1938 to a fight that takes place in the 1990s in his film. And the
okay.
way he cuts it together, it feels like it's part of the same sequence.
Interesting.
Yeah. And so that was a film that I thought was very good in that it was part of his purpose was to make us aware of this history that we seem to be continually forgetting or unable to even imagine that it actually happened.
And I think that's a lot of times what happens with history. You get one telling of it,
yeah.
and that's the one everyone latches onto, and then that's the way it was. I like it. I like it when, you know, I come across movies and things that challenge that, twist that, and say, hey, it wasn't necessarily like that.
Yeah, exactly. And that actually happens even with just the Western as a genre now. It's like there have been a whole bunch of Westerns that have come out in the past 15 years or so. Some of them have been pretty successful, like Django,
mm-hmm.
like True Grit, and like the Magnificent Seven that was out this...
I still haven't seen that one yet.
Yeah, I haven't seen that yet either, but it was a very successful
right.
box office film. But every time there is a Western that does not do well, it becomes like, well, this is the death of the Western, right?
Right.
So the trope of the death of the Western is one of those narratives that just continues to go on, and we forget True Grit, we forget Django Unchained, we only remember Aliens versus Cowboys.
Cowboys versus Aliens.
Yeah.
And then there was Bone Tomahawk with Kurt Russell that
yeah.
just came out.
Oh,
really violent movie.
Yeah. Did we have a conversation about that?
I don't think we did,
okay.
but man,
I had a conversation about that with someone.
Disturbingly violent. Yeah. Like, and I watch a whole bunch of violent. I got nothing against me some violent movies,
yeah.
But you know, cutting a man in half on screen was maybe a bit excessive.
Like, I might fast forward through that part.
Yeah, might want to skip that. All this talk about westerns. I have the weirdest western I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
Now, granted, it has nothing to do with African Americans in western, but it's called Lemonade Joe. Have you ever heard of it? It's a Czechoslovakian western that was made, probably, I guess, the 70s, maybe the 60s. All, you know, behind the Iron Curtain,
uh-huh.
All Czech actors, it's all in Czech. And it's sort of, it's made to be like what they perceived westerns to be
right.
like. And so it was sort of like the Czechoslovak version of a white western,
uh-huh.
like an American western.
Yeah.
And it's just bizarre. You've got the cowboy who comes in and he sings this song that my wife is from Slovakia. She's fluent in Czech
yeah.
and Slovak. And I'm listening to him, I'm like, what is he saying? She's like, he's not singing in English? I'm like, that's definitely not English. He's like, well, it's not Czech or Slovak either. They just made up a song that sounded to them like English sounded.
Wow.
And it's the theme of the song. Yeah, so if you ever want to see something strange, Lemonade Joe.
Actually, I have a colleague at Emerson College, Cynthia Miller, and she did an anthology of criticism on international westerns.
Okay.
And so they made, and the name sounds familiar.
So maybe it's in there. I would figure, because my wife was like, yeah, everybody knows this film. I was like, yeah, I don't.
Yeah.
How much research, like, well, typically when we ask some questions of each author as they come in, and one I have here is, what sort of research did you have to do for the book and how did you do it? I mean, this sounds like primarily this was a very research-driven book. How did you keep it all straight? How did you keep it all organized?
I guess in part because I didn't try to be comprehensive as such. Each chapter is sort of focused on a close read of a particular group of text, so I have sort of a smaller field of text that I'm looking at.
Okay.
Once you've divided it into chapters, the research is
sort of organizes.
Sort of organizes. You sort of, okay. So this is my chapter on TV westerns, right? So this is the 2 months that I'm going to be watching a lot of TV westerns.
Oh yeah.
Right. Or this is my chapter on a writer named Rose Gordon, who actually was she lived in Montana. And her writing was all in her local newspaper.
Okay.
And so this is the chapter where I sit down and I look at microfilms of the White Sulphur Springs newspapers.
Wow.
And, you know, see what you know, I read her columns. And
so you basically broke the book up into these separate chapters, wrote each chapter as you went, and then at the end wrote the end and done.
Something like that, yes.
So getting it published, did you have an editor already lined up, and or did you finish the book first and then you had to find an editor?
This is a case where I actually had an editor lined up. I talked with someone at the, I think it's the American Literature Association meeting. I don't quite know how this, I think he had saw my paper panel title and said he was interested in what I was doing, and then we talked with him at the conference, and so I did, and was interested in the book, and so I knew he shepherded the book all the way through,
right,
went pretty quickly. In this case, I sent him, I think, a couple of sample chapters and a proposal, and got the contract from the sample chapters and proposal, and then finished the book after that.
What was the most surprising thing you discovered in the course of writing the book?
I think it's the thing that I continually rediscover is that I keep thinking that I'm going to run out of material on the African American West, and I never do. There are always new things that I'm finding, even to this point.
So are you thinking about, do you write any follow-up to the book or any follow-up articles? I mean, like, I don't know much when it comes to writing academic books. I mean, I don't generally think they do sequels.
Uh-huh.
But is that something that you would do? I mean, was it well received, and there was space for more discussion on it?
It was well received. Actually, it got reprinted in paperback, which was good.
Wow, nice.
I was pleased to have that happen. Right now, I have been sort of a a parallel project that I've been working on is a biography, actually a sort of them become two biographies of Taylor Gordon and Rose Gordon. So Taylor Gordon was Rose Gordon's sister, and Taylor was a singer in the 1920s. She became famous as a singer of spirituals, and he wrote a autobiography that was in part about his life growing up in Sulphur Springs, Montana, and in part of kind of, you know, rags to riches story, celebrity autobiography,
right.
how he came to be a celebrity. So I'm not quite doing the same thing that I'm doing in Hoodoo Cowboys, but I'm still working with African American experience in the West, but this
okay.
time through the form of biography.
So sort of taking that and then going a little bit of a different direction
yeah.
with it.
Cool.
Okay, Kelly asks a question that I'm going to ask on her behalf. And
all
it's,
right.
it's stumped. She asked me this, it stumped me, it stumped Peter, so you might have to take a bit to think about this. Yeah, drink some coffee. If you could rewrite the ending of a fictitious character, who would it be and how would you change it?
The ending of a fictitious
character? Yeah, like take the outcome of a character from
mm-hmm.
any book,
mm-hmm.
and I'll throw in movies too to make it easier. If you could tweak it, and change it. How would you change it?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. It's hard to come up with something cold.
Yeah, I know.
is the problem.
I'll let you know. I went with Roy Hobbs from
mm-hmm.
The Natural because I was first introduced to the film version and loved the film version with Robert Redford, and then I read the book and loved the book, and then you get to the end and he sells out and loses and it's terrible, and you're like, what is this? And so I was upset with that. Although I think it's the right decision for the book. I get that. But the Robert Redford Natural fan in me wants him in the book as well to not sell out.
Actually, maybe I can give you a kind of an answer that's sort of parallel to the question.
Great.
So the Oscar Michaud was one of the writers that I talked about in the book. He also became a film director. In the 1920s, he did silent films as an independent black producer.
Wow.
And he first wrote about his experiences as a homesteader in South Dakota in a book called The Conquest.
Mm-hmm.
And this was like published in 1914, 1915. At the end of the book ends with him sitting in a room with his crops failed, his marriage destroyed, and about to lose his land that he's worked so hard on.
And that's the end?
And that's the end of the book, right? He goes back to that story all the way through his life. He retells that story in various forms. He writes a novel called The Homesteader
mm-hmm.
that basically is the same story but a little bit more fictionalized. And there are various of his films that also sort of repeat this story of, you know, the Western homesteader who goes out and tries to make it by himself and has all these travails. But all the later ones, he changed the ending so that he had a happy ending, right?
There you go.
So I, you know, for his own story, even he thought, okay, you know,
I'm gonna
give this a happy ending.
Well, it's like not that this is related genre wise, but do you know the movie Little Shop of Horrors?
Yeah,
with mm-hmm. Rick Moranis and Steve Martin in it.
Uh-huh.
Frank Oz, voice uh-huh. of Yoda and Miss Piggy, directed that, and uh-huh. It's of course. Interesting adaptation. I don't know if it's an adaptation of the Broadway musical, which is in turn an adaptation of a movie
right.
that is one of Jack Nicholson's first roles.
Right, right.
And
is there a dentist scene in
yes,
yes,
Steve
okay.
Martin,
right.
dentist, yeah, it's the famous one. So Frank Oz adapted the musical,
mm-hmm.
and the stage musical ends with the killer plant killing everybody and
uh-huh.
taking over the world. And so he filmed that. And then he tested it out, and people hated it. And so he went in and, he's like, okay, well, forget that. We're going to switch the ending. And they went back and completely changed the ending, so the plant... spoiler alert, the plant does die. And people were very relieved. So sometimes, I guess, people will actually say, well, okay, we're going to switch this right now and make it...
I think that was Oscar Michaud's philosophy, particularly with film,
yeah.
that he wanted to leave his audiences with a happy ending.
You know?
So... There you go. I personally, I prefer the ending of The Conquest, but you know, if he wants his character at the end of the story to get the girl, conquer the land and
more
have
power
all the
to him.
More
you
power
know.
To him.
What is your favorite Western?
My favorite Western. I think right now I'm going to say that my favorite Western is, let me look at the title.
Pause for a second.
I'll just edit this part out.
Your favorite Western is so favorite, you can't remember the name of it. But
I had all these things that I'm sort of going through my head here. This is the one that I guess I have been thinking about. So,
and tell me when you have it, and then we'll let Andrew know to unpause.
Yeah.
How long have we been going, Andrew?
You were at like 29 and a half minutes,
okay.
So.
Good.
Not too bad.
I'm almost done. We're almost done.
I think we'll finally pass the 30-minute mark.
Well, what? Two times ago, we went to like 39 minutes.
Yeah,
right?
That's true, yeah.
John and I just talked too much.
Granted, I mean, you have 2 hours to work with.
I know. I'm never going to go a whole 2 hours.
Exactly.
I don't know why I'm getting on this.
You got it?
Yeah. So,
okay, you ready?
Yeah. So I think my favorite Western right now is Buck and the Preacher. Buck and the Preacher,
okay.
Which was 1972. It was directed by Sidney Poitier and starring Sidney Poitier.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know he was in a Western.
He's in more than one, actually.
Interesting.
He sort of plays roles in Westerns in which they're kind of, I guess you could call it race-blind casting.
Okay.
Right? There's no indication in the story that he is racially different than anybody else,
huh.
Right? But Buck and the Preacher is much more of an exploration of racial issues. And it's a nice film. The bad guys in the film are actually a kind of Ku Klux Klan group that are threatening people.
Okay.
And so they're the outlaws that he has to face down. It's this sort of group of white vigilantes.
Interesting.
Buck and the Preacher. It's a film that is quite good on a number of levels and has been kind of forgotten.
Is it on Netflix or anything by any chance? Is it on DVD?
It's on DVD. I saw it on DVD.
Do we have a copy at the library?
That I do not know.
Remind me, we'll buy one.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm happy to get one.
Yeah. And it's a good fun film to watch.
Fantastic.
And if Sidney Poitier isn't enough, Harry Belafonte Jr. is also.
Really?
Yeah.
That sounds interesting.
Yeah.
So last question I have for you is just, where is your book available? Is it on just Amazon?
Most likely, or University Press of Mississippi's website would have it, but
okay.
It's also available on Amazon.
Is it Devaney's by any chance?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean,
sometimes,
literary criticism is not exactly a big seller.
Doesn't leap off the shelves,
no,
that's true.
Yeah.
But I always like to make sure people can say, well, this is where you can get the book if you want to buy it. So,
yeah.
So potentially directly from University of Mississippi. And also probably Amazon.
Or whatever other online
wherever books online books are sold.
Yes, wherever online
okay.
books are sold. Wherever they have big warehouses for
yes.
books.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. I've learned a lot. I've enjoyed it. And I want to check out your book sometime. So
thanks.
Thanks
a lot. I enjoyed it.
Okay. Bye-bye, folks.